Let's start with the Medrash, or Gemara really, and we'll build it around that. The Gemara says that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Moshe Rabbeinu to build the Mishkan, so he basically told him to first make the Mishkan, the base of the Mishkan itself, the Kroshim and the outer confines of the Mishkan, and then to make the Kelim, the Aron and the other Kelim. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he commanded Bezalel, turned it around. And he told Bezalel first to make the Kelim and then to make the Mishkan. Bezalel said, it can't be. That can't be the order. Because if I make the Kelim and then the Mishkan, Kelim Shaniyosa Lahechon Achnisim, we're going to put the Kelim. It's not the way that people build a house. First you build the house, then you have the furniture and put it in. You don't make your furniture and then build a house around it. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, you know what? You're right. Bitzel Kel Hayisom V'yodata. You were in the shadow of God and you knew what he actually told me. And that's why he was called Bezalel. Very difficult Gemara. For a few reasons. First of all, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't understand what the Rav Amram told him. He needed Bezalel to correct him. That opens a Pandora's box on the fact that maybe Moshe Rabbeinu made mistakes and other things too. And nobody corrected him. And if Moshe Rabbeinu knew what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, but he tried to trick Bezalel, how does Moshe Rabbeinu have the right to fool around with the Dvar Hashem? Thirdly, Sales is always a euphemism for doubt. Shilo shel safek. Right? Ain't sales shel safek. There's no shadow of a doubt. And the English would say that. The shadow of a doubt. Masha ain't king or is the sign of clarity. In bor lechok hashemesh. It's clear as sunlight, as the light. If Bezalel hit the mark, and he knew what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said and understood better than Moshe, then why was he called Bezalel? Bezalel, you were in the shadow of God. He should have been in the light of God. Because he knew what it was. Why was he called Bezalel? He should have been called Orkel. Not Bezalel. So in order to understand this, I want to start with what would seem to be something unrelated, but we will relate it eventually. Take my word for it. The Aron, it says, was made gold on the inside, gold on the outside, and wood in the middle. And from there we learn that a Talmid Chacham has to be Tocho Kibaro. His inside has to be like his outside. That is the Lashon of Chazal, Tocho Kibaro. From that expression, which comes first? The inside or the outside? Okay, think again. What does it say? Your inside should be like your outside. Which one's first? The outside, and then the inside conforms to that. That doesn't seem to be the way that things should be. Which is the ikur? What a person does on the outside or what his feelings are on the inside? Right, the outside is not the ikur for sure. The ikur is the pnimius, not the chitzonius. Not just going through the motions is the main thing. The main thing is what you believe, what you feel, not just what you do. So wouldn't it be better if it said that the Talmid Chacham has to be his outside like his inside? Baro ketocho. First work on the inside, and then you'll see that the outside also fits the inside, that the ikur is the inside. The answer is that that's not the way that things work in this world. And to illustrate it, I will give you a story. I don't know why I think that we learned this, but if we did, you'll remember the story. When I was a rabbi in Miami, So there was a woman in my kehila who grew up, I hate to give labels, but in a more, a less serious approach to Yiddishkeit. Here in Israel, they call it Dati Light, which means that, you know, the parents, her parents kept kosher, but anything that had a K on the label, even in the name of the product, was already kosher. They kept Shabbos. They didn't drive on Shabbos. They didn't answer the phone or turn on lights, but Hilchos Shabbos, they never heard of. Right? That was like too much. And the Tznius, pretty much, they never heard of. The mother didn't cover her hair, and they wore obviously clothing in Miami. It was a mazel if anybody wore clothing altogether. But there, they wore short sleeves, whatever. And this is the home that this young woman grew up in. She got married, and she had her first child. And something hit her that she wants something more serious and meaningful for her children. So she decided that she's going to become more serious about Yiddishkeit. And her husband went along with this. And they started first by upgrading their kashrus. They kashered their home. Whether they had to or not is questionable, but they did. And they started being makbid only to get things that were reliably kosher. And then they sat and went to shiurim on Hilchos Shabbos and became very much more aware of Hilchos Shabbos. And finally, this woman really, the whole household, upgraded their Yiddishkeit, and I felt she was ready for the next step, which means to start dressing the part. So I called her in and I said, you know, look, you've upgraded your kashrus, you upgraded your Shabbos. I said, now I think you have to start dressing according to halacha too. That means you have to start covering your hair and start wearing clothing that is according to halacha. At that time in Miami, most of the regular balabatim, the women did not dress according to halachic standards, especially most married women didn't cover their hair. And only the Rebbetzins, the Clay Kodesh, the day school teachers' wives covered their hair. So a woman said to me, Rabbi, I don't feel inside like a Rebbetzin. I don't want to be a hypocrite. I don't want to dress like a Rebbetzin, and people will think that's how I actually feel when I don't feel like that. I don't want to be a hypocrite. As soon as I feel like a Rebbetzin, I will dress like one. I told her, you know what you can be compared to? Imagine somebody who comes to shul on Simchas Torah, and he says, I don't really feel happy inside. And if I get up and dance with the Torah, I'm a hypocrite. Because people are going to think that I'm happy, and I'm not really happy. So I'm going to sit here and contemplate being happy. And as soon as I'm happy, I'm going to get up and dance. The guy will sit there till Tisha B'Av. How do you get happy? By dancing. You don't get happy by contemplating happiness. The way that you generate happiness is by going through the motions. Motions generate emotions. That's the whole Torah. All the Torah is the Sefer HaChinuch says, HaChitzonios Me'orerim Es HaPnimios. That which is on the outside, we're human beings. And what affects us and what generates inner emotions, beliefs, is going through the motions. That's not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is where you want to make a show and you want people to think that you believe something or that you feel something and you don't even want to do that, you just want to make a show. That's hypocrisy. But when you want to get to that goal and the way to do it is to go through the emotions, to go through the motions, then that's not hypocrisy, that's the way of the world. In order to be happy, you have to dance. And then eventually you get happy. You want that goal. So you're not trying to put on a show as if you're happy. You're trying to get happy. I told her, if you continue dressing in an immodest way, you're never going to feel modest. The way that you get to feel modest is by dressing modestly. That affects how you feel. So So that is the way, therefore, in this world, the reality is that toho kibaro, first you do the externals. You go through the motions, and that's not hypocrisy. And eventually the motions create emotions. Yes?
So the sacrifice to say that they don't want to do X because they don't want to be a hypocrite, does that stop as a self-user by them doing X and not you? Would not be
a hypocrisy. Right. Hypocrisy is only where you don't want to reach the goal and you want people to think that you're there. That may be hypocrisy. Even that I'm not sure. Because still there's an Indian to go through the motions too. Maybe it'll have an effect.
Okay, they got thought process of
ISIS,
you don't
want to
do so that people
turn. Yeah, that's a
Yetzer Hara. That itself. Then if someone
really believes
that, then that essentially makes it
non-hypocritical,
regardless of what it's
doing. Right, basically. In other words, if they do it, they're not hypocritical at all. Right. That's a Yetzer Hara. I don't want to do it because I don't want to be a hypocrite when it has nothing to do with hypocrisy. It's just the way of the Yetzer Hara to stop you doing it, because the Yetzer Hara knows that if you do it, you may end up thinking and feeling that way, and he doesn't want you to do that. So there is something positive about going through the motions, because that in this physical world is the way to get to the emotions. So that is the idea of toho kibaro. Yes.
So what about people that do go through the motions but don't have the emotions?
That what?
That don't have the emotions back.
Again, you don't. It's hard to say that a person doesn't have any emotions. You don't know. You may not be the biggest tzaddikus in the world. But avadai, if a person, let's take the tzniyas, if you dress tzanua, you may not feel inside like a rebbitzin, but you definitely will feel more tzanua than if you walk around in a bikini. You're never going to feel tzanua if you dress untzanua. You may feel something if you, the externals will have an effect on your internal feelings, whether it's a great effect or a little effect, it's something. Unless you don't want it to happen at all and you just want to put on a show. But most people aren't like that. Okay. There's only one problem. Sounds very nice, and it sounds like it's true, and it is. But there's one problem. The Torah doesn't say that. That's how the rabbis describe the Aron. Toho kibaro. Based on that, we just said this very nice piece of Torah. But the Torah doesn't say that. The Torah says, when it comes to the Aron, v'tzipisa oso zahav tahor, you should cover it with gold, with pure gold, mibayis umichutz titzapenu, on the inside and on the outside. Which is the Torah mentioned first? The inside. So, where do the rabbis get to say the outside comes first and then the inside, when the Torah says the opposite? First comes the inside, then the outside. Mibayis or michutz. Therefore, I want to say the following. That really there are three stages. If the Torah had just said by the Aron, v'tzipisa oso zahav tahor, where would you put the gold?
Okay.
On the outside, like all the other cavers. The shulchan was overlaid with gold. Right, the mizbeach hazohav was overlaid with gold. So the Torah just said that tzipisa oso zahav to harden the outside. Then the Torah says mibayis inside. Then bachutz again outside. There were three stages: outside, then inside, which is what Chazal say toho kibaro, and then again outside, outside, inside, outside. Now how does that work? Why did they have to do it outside, inside, and then again outside? Very simple. Rashi says how the Aron was made. There were three boxes. A medium-sized box of wood, a smaller box of gold, and a larger box of gold. They first put the wooden box inside the golden box. Now the Aron was covered where? On the outside. Okay, the wooden box was inside the golden box, so the golden box covered it on the outside. Then they put the little golden box inside the wooden box. Now it was covered where? on the inside. What wasn't covered? The rim. If you look down at the Arum, you saw a sandwich. Gold, wood, gold. That wood also had to be covered. So then they covered the outside of the rim with gold. So it's exactly what it says. First, cover it on the outside by putting the wooden box in the big gold box. Then cover it on the inside by putting the little gold box inside the wooden box. And then cover the external rim with gold. So it these three stages. Outside, inside, and outside again. Now what does that stand for? So now we've answered why the outside comes first and then the inside. But how about the second outside? So let's go back to the person on Simchas Torah. Person comes to shul and he really doesn't feel happy with the Torah. So what do we tell him to do? Don't sit there and think about being happy. Get up and dance. And when he dances, he's going to begin to feel happy. Now he's dancing and he really feels happy. His externals have influenced his internal feelings. And he really feels happy now with the Torah. Should he stop dancing now? Since the dancing was only to generate that happiness, now you're happy, so you don't need the dancing anymore. Now sit down and just bask in your happiness. Or should he continue dancing? Why? It could go away, yeah, but there's even something more significant. Let me tell you what the Svasema says, or he quotes a Ramban. The Ramban is in his Perush al Aseres HaDibros. It's not part of his Perush al HaTorah. It's a separate work the Ramban had, Perush al Aseres HaDibros. The truth is I could not find this, but the Svasema says there's such a Ramban. I take his word for it. Even though it sounds more like a Hasidic Shavuot than the Ramban, but he says the Ramban says this. It's a Pasuk in Shir HaShirim. The Pasuk says, Mato'iru umato'oruru es ho'ahava ad shetechpot. Says the Ramban. If a person has a tremendous feeling, an emotion of love or fear for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, don't leave it in an ethereal realm. Ad shetechpot, put it into something concrete. Express it in a physical, concrete way. Meaning, even if you have this tremendous feeling of love and simcha, whatever, express it in a physical way. Because that's when it becomes more real. It says that most mitzvahs that we do, that we reach, or supposed to reach, various spiritual levels, what do we accompany those mitzvahs with? A meal. Suda's mitzvah. Put it into something concrete. In fact, some say that was what it says by Nadav and Avihu. Not like Rashi says that they did something wrong. But there are Rishonim who learned, and Midrashim, that it was what they did was fine. It says, Vayechazu Eso Elokim, they came to a tremendously high level of prophecy, of understanding the Rabbanu Shalom, Vayochlu Vayishtu. And they went and ate and drank. Because they wanted to express it in a physical way. The highest level in this world is not things that are emotions alone, but emotions that are expressed externally. Because we are in a physical world, what affects us is physical things. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, the Sefer HaIkarim says, Moshe Rabbeinu heard from HaKadosh Baruch Hu a blow-by-blow description of what was happening down at the foot of Har Sinai with the eagle. Yet he didn't break the luchos until he saw it with his own eyes. Not because he didn't believe. Because what affects a person in this world is his physical things. And there's a Ramosha Cordovero says that the neshamos in Gan Eden look forward to Tchias HaMeisim, when they'll be able to occupy a body again, as much as we look forward to Mashiach. It's a higher level. You would think that the neshama is on a higher level when it's in spiritual worlds. Not true. The highest level is when it comes into a physical world and it's able to express the high spiritual ideas and emotions physically. That is more real. That's a higher level. Based on that, hold on one second, just finish the idea, and then based on that, there's a Ramban. The Ramban says that Olam Haba and Tchiyas HaMeisim are one and the same. Unlike the Rambam. The Rambam says Olam Haba is a spiritual world. Tchiyas HaMeisim is a period in history prior to that when the Meisim will come back to life for various reasons, and then they'll go back to Olam Haba, the spiritual world. The final stage of history, according to the Rambam, is spiritual. But the Ramban says no. There'll come a time when the Nishamos will go back into a body, and they will exist eternally in a body, and that's called Olam Haba. Olam Haba is a world that does not exist now. It's a world that will be refashioned to accommodate physical and spiritual beings that are eternal. The problem with that Ramban is that the Gemara describes Olam Haba in a very not physical way. Ein lo bo achila velo shtia. There's no eating, there's no drinking. So it sounds like it's not a physical place, says the Ramban. Just because a person doesn't eat or drink doesn't mean he's not physical. Moshe Rabbeinu was still a physical being. He had a body. But for 40 days and 40 nights, he didn't eat and he didn't drink. The body will be on a level where it doesn't need to eat and drink to survive. The neshama will keep the body going, as opposed to in this world where the body keeps the neshama going. So then they ask on the Ramban, very nice, then what do you need your body for? If you're not going to have to be involved in the physical necessities of life, then why have a physical body? But based on this, the answer is very simple. The body serves two purposes. In this world, the body creates the atmosphere, the environment for the neshama to function. You need to get your body going, right, before you can get your neshama to kick in. You have to dance to be happy. You have to eat and drink for simcha, whatever it may be. You have to go through the motions to get to emotions. So the body needs to create the environment for the neshama. And then, once it creates that environment, then the body expresses those feelings in a physical, material way. Two sides of the thing. The body initiates the emotions, and then the body expresses the emotions. In Olam Haba, Tchiyas HaMeisim, you won't need the body to create the emotions. The neshama will be able to create them on its own, but you'll still need the body to express them, because emotions that aren't expressed in a physical way are not as concrete and real as ones that are. So the body will be the expressor of the neshama, not the initiator of the neshama in Olam Haba. Okay, you still with me? Okay. Now, okay, somebody had a question here? Yeah.
Motions generate emotions that should be generating more motions?
Right, no. Motions generate emotions, and then the motions express those emotions in a more quality, concrete way, where they become on a higher level than if just they would be emotions flying in the air. Right. And then once they're happy, they express that happiness through dancing, is a much more quality happiness than where it's just ethereal and just a feeling. So the dancing originally generates the feeling, and then the dancing expresses that feeling once you have it. Okay. Now, let's get back to the Mishnah. Before the Chet HaEgel, there still was going to be a Mishkan. After the Chet HaEgel, the Mishkan took on a new aspect as a kapara for the Chet HaEgel. Meaning there would have been a Mishkan even if there had not been a Chet HaEgel. But it would have had a different function. It took on different functions because of the Chet HaEgel, to be a kapara for the Chet HaEgel also. It was an extra added dimension of the Mishkan. There's a difference in what the Mishkan would have generated or what its purpose was before the Chet HaEgel and after the Chet HaEgel. Before the Chet HaEgel, the Torah says, "Bechol ha-makom asher azker eshmi, avo elecho ve'irachticho." Wherever I will mention my name, you'll feel my presence. It doesn't have to be in any special place in the world. Klal Yisrael were on the level before the Chet HaEgel to feel God's presence anywhere in the world. You could come to a feeling of God's presence without a Mishkan. So what was the purpose of the Mishkan? Once you have that feeling anywhere, come to the Mishkan and use the Kalim of the Mishkan to express those feelings. The purpose of the Mishkan was not to generate the feelings, but to express them, because they could be generated anywhere. You didn't need a Mishkan to generate them. They only had the second purpose of the Chitzonius, to express the feelings, not to generate them. After the Chet HaEgel, there people became much more limited, and you needed the Mishkan to be able to generate that feeling of God's presence. And once you came to the Mishkan and you had that feeling, now you could express it through the various kalim of the Mishkan. So it served two purposes. One, to generate the feeling, and the other, to express it. In generating the feeling, the main thing was the framework of the Mishkan itself. You came to a place, to a house, where you felt God's presence. So the Mishkan itself, the building of the Mishkan, is what generated those feelings. The Kalim were the ability to then use the Kalim in expressing those feelings. So before the Chet HaEgel, the main thing was the Kalim. You can get those feelings anywhere. You don't need the Mishkan to generate those feelings. But you need the Kalim of the Mishkan to express those feelings and to enhance them, intensify them, and make you more aware of the Ribbono Shel Olam's presence. So before the Chet HaEgel, which came first? The Mishkan or the Kalim? The Kalim, and then the Mishkan. HaKadosh Baruch Hu knew there was going to be a Chet HaEgel. So ultimately he knew that first would have to come the Mishkan and then the Kalim. But he couldn't tell Moshe Rabbeinu that. He had to hide that from Moshe Rabbeinu. Because if Moshe Rabbeinu heard first Mishkan and then Kalim, he would say, "What's going on? You don't need a Mishkan first and then the Kalim. The Kalim are what create the feeling of the Mishkan. You don't need that feeling first. You get that anywhere." And Moshe would have then understood that something's going to change, and there's going to be a Chet HaEgel which changes their level. And Moshe couldn't know that, because the Meshech Chochma says that even though HaKadosh Baruch Hu's knowledge does not interfere with free choice, but human knowledge, or even the knowledge of angels, does interfere. So there's no way that Moshe Rabbeinu could have sensed that something was going to change that would have affected their free choice. Therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam had to hide from Moshe Rabbeinu what the real tzibui was. He had to make it obscure. He had to make him think that he meant first the Kalim and then the Mishkan, when in fact he meant the other way, but he had to hide that from Moshe Rabbeinu. So literally he put Moshe Rabbeinu in the dark, because he didn't want him to understand what ultimately the way the Mishkan would be built, because it was going to be built after the Chet HaEgel, and the Ribbono Shel Olam knew there was going to be a Chet HaEgel, but he couldn't describe that in a way that Moshe Rabbeinu would be sensitive to it. So he had to hide it from him. So he obscured it, and he made Moshe Rabbeinu think that first would come the Kalim and then the Mishkan. When Moshe gave this over to Bezalel, it was after the Chet HaEgel. So Bezalel said, "Bokach min hago shel olam, this is not the way the world is now. We need a Mishkan first, and then the Kalim, because if we don't have the Mishkan, where are you going to put the Kalim? They're not going to have any effect. First you have to generate the feeling before you can express it. You need something concrete to generate the feelings, not just to express them. And Moshe Rabbeinu told him, Taka, now looking back, I understand that the Ribbono Shel Olam put me in the dark. So I shouldn't understand this because he didn't want me to understand this at the time that he told me, because that was before the Chet HaEgel. And you, Bezalel, Betzel, Kael, Ha'yisa, V'yodata, you understood that shadow, that the Ribbono Shel Olam put me into that shadow of doubt, and understood that really the Ribbono Shel Olam meant the other way, but he didn't want me to know that because that was before the Chet HaEgel, and I would have gotten the sense that something's going to change, something's going to happen, and the Jewish people are going to fall from the level they're on, and that would have affected their free choice. That's why he was called Bezalel. That's the idea. Yeah.
First of all, if human knowledge can affect free choice, then what about any time Hashem told any Navi about what was going to happen in the future?
Because a Navi can still change. Right? When a Navi is told something for the good, it doesn't change. But even if the people don't deserve it. But if he's told something for the bad, people can still do tshuva, and it can change. What the Ribbono Shel Olam tells a Navi is said on condition that tshuva isn't done. But what people know and has nothing to do anymore with Nevuah. It's what they discern on their own that would affect free choice. Nevuah is a special thing. Nevuah is given on condition. So it takes into consideration the fact that people still have free choice. It's not for sure.
Because Moshe's level of Nevuah was different,
Right, here it wasn't a Nevuah to Moshe Rabbeinu telling him about what was going to be. It was something he would infer from something else, which wasn't given on condition or whatever. That he couldn't infer.
But also, like when Yaakov was walking in front, didn't Yaakov know when the, like on the shelf, or somehow that not affect, like,
hearing? Could be for that reason it was hidden from him. Right.
But he knew it, so he
went into the room. Well, it says that that case could be that he didn't know, aside from the fact that that's the reason why it says that all the details of Mashiach nobody can know. Even a Navi, even a Chacham, can't know those details because they depend on our Madrega, how they're going to be, and that would affect our free choice. Yeah.
Nowadays,
though,
like when we don't have a
mishkan
or anything, like we're still able to,
generate
the feeling.
That's why we sit on the floor every Tisha B'Av and cry. Because as the Kuzri says, yeah, we have all these things and we still have mitzvahs, but we're like a dead body compared to a living person. It's just a facade. It's not the real thing. Right? And even though it appears to be the real thing, if we know what the real thing was, we know that this is not what it's way it's supposed to be. To give you an example of that, I always like to say this when Tisha B'Av falls on Shabbos. It says that they never instituted a 24-hour fast day on Sunday. In other words, for rain or for something like that, where they instituted full fast, like Yom Kippur, right, or Tisha B'Av, they never instituted on Sunday. Because from going from Shabbos to the antithesis of a total fast day, like with all the Inuyim, is dangerous, it's life-threatening. We do it all the time. We have Tisha B'Av falls on Sunday. Yom Kippur can't, for different reasons. But Tisha B'Av can. So, and nobody ever died because they fasted on Sunday, Tisha B'Av, right away after Shabbos. But the answer is that in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, Shabbos was so different that going from a Shabbos like that to a fast would have been life-threatening. But after the Beis HaMikdash, Shabbos is a very diminished Shabbos, and therefore there's no problem. Okay, just one example of what is missing. Okay. Okay, any questions on that? I think that suffices for, let me go to something else in the end of the Sedra. It says that when they came to put up the Mishkan, so they couldn't put up the crushing. physically. They couldn't put them up. And they brought it to Moshe Rabbeinu, and they couldn't mamish it. They just couldn't. It was impossible to put up. So Moshe Rabbeinu said, I can't put it up either. So the Rabbanu Shlom told him the following. Moshe Rabbeinu felt bad, the Medrash says, that he really didn't have any personal part in the building of the Mishkan. He supervised everything, but he didn't build anything. He didn't do anything. So the Rabbanu Shlom told him, don't worry. When it comes time to put up the actual Mishkan, nobody's going to be able to do it. You're going to do it. So they brought it to Moshe Rabbeinu, and he said, I can't do it either. The Rabbanu Shlom said, don't worry. Put your hand on it, and I'll put it up, and it'll look like you're putting it up. That is the Medrash. A few problems. First of all, during the Midbar, when they were in Mitzrayim, they took the Kroshim with them and carried them with them the whole time. What was the big deal? They can carry these Kroshim with them out of Mitzrayim. Why can't they put them up now? So obviously it was a nace that they couldn't put them up. The Rabbanu Shlom prevented them from putting it up. Okay? So now, why couldn't Moshe Rabbeinu put it up? So the Rabbanu Shlom will take away that nace of preventing them from putting it up and let Moshe Rabbeinu do it. Secondly, if the whole purpose that the Rabbanu Shlom reserved this for Moshe Rabbeinu is because he didn't have a personal part, and now he wanted to give him a personal part, he still didn't have a personal part, it just looked like he did. So why should that make Moshe Rabbeinu feel okay? He knows better, he knows he didn't put anything up, the Rabbanu Shlom did it. So why would that make Moshe Rabbeinu feel good? He still didn't have a part in the Mishkan. He just had a apparent part, but he knows that it really wasn't him. So why did that placate him? The Meshech Chochma says that there is nothing in this world that has intrinsic kedusha. Nothing is intrinsically holy. What gives it holiness is the Ribono Shel Olam and through the Torah. Torah makes something holy. There's nothing intrinsically holy. Therefore, Har Sinai, as long as the Shechinah was there, was holy. The Shechinah left, it became a regular mountain. Animals could graze on it. It didn't get any intrinsic holiness. There's nothing in this world that has intrinsic holiness. Har Abayis is only holy because the Shechinah never leaves there. So it's holy because of the Shechinah. What is the expression of the Shechinah? Ratzon Hashem is the Torah. The Torah confers holiness and importance on things. There's nothing that is intrinsically holy. Let me tell you a story that illustrates this. Yes? Or after a person dies, his body, that's because, not that he's intrinsically holy, but since he was a receptacle to Torah, so even the clothing of the Torah is important. But not because intrinsically holy. It's because it served as a receptacle for that holiness when it was there. The story that goes along with this is the following. It's a true story. Again, when I was a rabbi in Miami, so I got a call from one of my balabatim, a woman, and she was frantic. I remember it was Tzom Gedalia. She called me and she said, Rabbi, you have to do something with my husband because I'm afraid that he is going to die if you don't talk some sense into him. So I said, calm down. What is the problem? She said the following. So my husband has a chronic disease. I don't remember exactly what it was. Could have been diabetes. I don't remember what. It's under control. He has a diet. He has medication. And he's able, Baruch Hashem, to live a normal life. He went for a checkup today by the doctor. And the doctor said that his condition has changed. And he can't fast on Yom Kippur. Because if he doesn't eat 3 normal meals every day, then it could lead to Sakonis Nefashos. So he has to eat 3 normal meals on Yom Kippur, not fast at all and not eat shiurim. He has to eat a normal meal. The doctor told him what is a normal meal for him. And this is every day of the year, including Yom Kippur. When we left the doctor, my husband turned to me, said this woman, and he said, I have not eaten on Yom Kippur since my bar mitzvah, and I don't plan to start now, and I'm not going to eat on Yom Kippur, I'm going to fast. And I'm afraid my husband's going to die. So somebody has to talk some sense into him that he can't fast on Yom Kippur. So I said, fine. I asked for the number of the doctor. The doctor was not a religious person. So I asked the doctor to explain to me why he felt this person has to eat 3 regular meals on Yom Kippur. And he explained to me the medical necessity. And I called another doctor, a frum doctor, and I said, if you had a patient with this condition, the way it was described to me, what would you tell that patient to do for Yom Kippur? He said they have to eat 3 regular meals. Right, because if this guy doesn't eat 3 regular meals, the way you just described what the doctor told you, right, his life is in danger. Okay. I called the man in, and I said, I spoke to your wife, and I spoke to your doctor, and I spoke to another doctor. And everybody confers that you have to eat 3 regular meals on Yom Kippur, and therefore I'm telling you, as your Rav, that you have to eat on Yom Kippur 3 regular meals. He said, Rabbi, you're a nice man. You're about a third my age. I was much younger then, not that he was so old. And you can't tell me what to do. And I haven't eaten on Yom Kippur since my bar mitzvah, and I don't plan to start now. I'm going to fast on Yom Kippur. So I said to him, you're right. I can't tell you what to do. Right? I can't force you to eat on Yom Kippur. You're right 100%. However, I do run this shul. And I'm telling you now that as soon as you leave my office, I am going to call the gabbai of the shul and instruct him never to give you another honor in this shul. Nothing. You are persona non grata over here. You don't exist in this shul when it comes to kibbutzim. He looked at me and says, on what grounds? I said, we are makel to give people who are not necessarily Shomer Shabbos kibbutzim in the shul for various reasons. But we have never given an idol worshiper kibud in this shul, and I don't plan to start now. And you're an idol worshiper. He looked at me like I was out of my mind. I said, look, the God that we worship in this shul said that you have to eat on Yom Kippur. Now, you obviously have another God. And I don't really care if you call your God Zeus, Jupiter, or Yom Kippur. You have the Yom Kippur God. The Yom Kippur God said you have to fast on Yom Kippur. Right? My God said you have to eat on Yom Kippur. But since you worship the Yom Kippur God, who said that you have to fast, right, you're an idol worshiper. So I don't really care if you worship Yom Kippur or you worship Zeus or Jupiter. You're an idol worshiper. You're not going to get an Aliyah or any kibbutz in the shul. Lemaisa, he ate on Yom Kippur. See how important Aliyahs are. But it's true. Wasn't a joke. Yom Kippur is only important because the Rabban Shalom said it's important. And if that same Rabban Shalom says that in this situation you have to eat, then that's Ratzon Hashem. Then that's what's important. Yom Kippur has no intrinsic value, nor does anything in the Torah have intrinsic value. The Torah gives it value, and the Torah gives it conditions when it's valuable, when not. And therefore, it's only the Torah that makes the Mishkan important. The Mishkan has no intrinsic value. It only gets Kedusha because of Torah. And who is the Torah? Moshe Rabbeinu. But it's not Moshe Rabbeinu. He is just the pipeline for Ratzon Hashem. That's how the Rabban Shalom communicates the Torah through Gedolei Yisrael. Therefore, no one could put up the Mishkan not to give the idea that the Mishkan has intrinsic Kedusha. It doesn't. It's only viable, it's only Kedusha comes through the Torah, which is represented by Moshe Rabbeinu. But Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't make up the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu is only the vehicle through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu conveys the Torah. Therefore, Moshe didn't put it up either. HaKadosh Baruch Hu put it up, but he put it up through Moshe Rabbeinu. Not only that, but it says that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't only put up the Mishkan, but for 7 days before Shmini L'Miluim, Every single day, Moshe Rabbeinu put up the Mishkan and took it down. And put it up again and took it down. Now, I'd understand if that was Moshe Rabbeinu's job and he was getting practice, so he had to know how to take it down and put it up. But Moshe Rabbeinu didn't do this afterwards. What was the purpose of taking it down and putting it up for 7 days? Well, the answer is that not only when the Gadol Hador puts up the Mishkan, do you have to have Emunas Chachamim and realize that he's the one who tells you whether this Mishkan has Kedusha or not, but even when it appears like the Gadol of Israel is tearing down the Mishkan, that's also Emunas Chachamim. Sometimes the Rebbe Shlomo instructs Gadol Israel to do what appears to be tearing down Kedusha, but that's also Stiras Zikein in Binyan. That's Ratzon Hashem too. Sometimes you have to eat on Yom Kippur, destroy it, tear down the Mishkan. But that's Ratzon Hashem. That is how we know what's holy, what's right, what's good, is only the Torah defines it. And if the Torah doesn't define it, nothing has intrinsic kedusha in this world. And if the Rebbe Shlomo says to a Gadol, tear down the Mishkan, then that's what Ratzon Hashem is, and they have to tear down the Mishkan. That's the way to get kedusha. Not by building it, tearing it down. So that's a tremendous lesson, I think, of why the Mishkan could not be put up by anybody except Moshe Rabbeinu, and even he didn't put it up. He just was the vehicle through which HaKadosh Baruch Hu put up the Mishkan.